Selections for reading: The War, L.I., War Committee, H.O. Clough, D.C. Allen, L.S. Mills, G.C. Swift, State of Connecticut Seal, 1918, State Board of Education, Hartford, Connecticut. The Great War, Germany. The Teutons are of Aryan descent and came from Asia before the dawn of history. First mention is made of them at about 330 B.C., when they were described as living between the Rhine and the Baltic Sea. They were said to be of tall stature, fair complexion, and to have yellow or red hair. They were of great strength and fond of fighting. Their homes were among the trees in rude huts. The women were required to do most of the work. The next account of them is in 113 B.C., when the Cimbri and Teutons invaded northern Italy and cut to pieces several Roman armies. They were, however, checked by the Roman consul Marius at the Battle of Vercelli a few years later. When Caesar began his campaigns in Gaul in 58 B.C., he found great numbers of the Teutons south of the Rhine. After many hard-fought battles, he defeated them and drove them back across the Rhine. Caesar was the first writer to call the Teutons Germans. After this, German tribes, though not subdued, were kept in check by the Romans until A.D. 9, when the Roman general Verus attempted to conquer them. This army was destroyed by the Germans under Hermann in the Teutoburg Forest in Germany. During the next 400 years, Rome and the various branches of the Germanic people contended for supremacy. After periods of fighting, there were long periods of peace when vast numbers of Germans settled within the Roman Empire, learned the Latin language, and took up Roman customs. Then again, tribe after tribe of the Germans fought with the Romans, and Rome was sacked again and again. The Romans called the Germans barbarians and tried by means of their armies, their walls, and their guard to hold them back. The Germans gained slowly, both by fighting and by settling within the Roman Empire. In 476, Odoacer, the most powerful among the rival German generals in Italy, banished their last Roman emperor and rules in his place. Political power passed from the Roman to the Teuton, who had neither art nor science, neither philosophy nor literature. The Dark Ages began and lasted nearly 1,000 years. However, the Germans had personal vigor, a fine independent spirit, and unbounded capacity for growth and development. Odoacer was soon overthrown by Theodoric, another one of the rival German generals, and soon another displaced Theodoric. The Germans contended among themselves and against the Romans in this manner for about 300 years. Few people could read and write in those days, so there is little left to tell us what really did happen. During the same period, the Bishop of Rome became Pope. Many matters formerly belonging to the Roman government were neglected by the German rulers and in consequence were taken over by the Church of Rome. Some of the most important of these were education, wills, deeds, lawsuits, marriage obligations, and dispensations of charity. In this way, the Church of Rome, under the direction of the Pope, became in many respects more powerful than the kings. One of the first popes to have great power and influence was Pope Gregory, 590 A.D. For many years, he maintained order at Rome. Pope Gregory was one of the best educated men of the Dark Ages and one of the best writers. As time passed, the Gauls became known as Franks. Their power over the other German peoples increased. In 752, the Pope anointed a Frankish king called Pippin to be king at Rome. This was the first time the Pope assumed the power of the appointment of a king. By the year 800 A.D., the Germans had full power over all the Western world. Charlemagne, king of the Franks, a branch of the Teutonic race, was crowned emperor at Rome. He had dominion over the German world, which included Italy and all of Western and Central Europe. Charlemagne brought the barbaric people of Germany into the pale of civilization and brought about union among the mixed tribes. Germany as a separate nation began at this time. For 400 years, beginning with Charlemagne, the German kings were also Roman emperors and ruled Italy as well as all Germany. Italy and all Western Europe constituted the Holy Roman Empire. During this time, the Christian religion spread from Rome to Britain and across the Rhine to the cold shores of the far Baltic Sea. The German rulers, crowned as Roman emperors, tried to become emperors of the world. They strove with the Pope for absolute control in religious matters. In this, they usually failed. However, their ambition knew no bounds. The pursuit of this phantom of the world rule worked woeful consequences to Germany. In trying to grasp too much, these German rulers seized nothing at all. In trying to subdue foreign peoples and the Pope, home matters were neglected. Frederick Barbarossa, 1152 to 1190, was the most brilliant of these German rulers. He fought many hard battles in Italy in order to retain his authority. The Pope opposed Frederick, and in 1176, at the Battle of Legnano, Frederick was defeated. By the Treaty of Venice, which followed, most of the Italian towns became free republics. With the death of Frederick II, the grandson of Frederick Barbarossa in 1250, the great German Roman Empire ceased. By this time, France, England, and Italy were separated from German control. The fierce struggles of the German kind with the Pope had brought about neglect and strife in Germany. Germany, which had for over 300 years been the strongest state in Europe, now lost its unity and power and broke into 300 separate and independent states. It, however, retained the name of the Holy Roman Empire, but its kings were no longer crowned at Rome, nor did they have much real power. They continued the struggle with the Pope for supremacy. For some 300 years, Germany remained in this condition, and with no law except that of the fist. In 1517, Martin Luther, a German scholar, objected to the infallibility of the Pope at Rome and took the Bible as the rule of conduct in faith. This was the birth of Protestantism. This spread and caused a century of wars between the Catholic and Protestants. The last of these wars was the Thirty Years' War, which ended in 1648 when a peace was signed at Westphalia. The terms of this peace allowed tolerance so that people might be free to follow either the Catholic or Protestant belief without molestation. The wars over this question had so devastated Germany that it did not recover until about 1850. In 1611, Frederick William of the House of Hohenzollern ruled in Brandenburg. This German state included the present city of Berlin. In 1618, Frederick William secured control of Prussia and became ruler of the dual state. He ruled with force and established authority. He spent much of his time in military organization and raised, thoroughly drilled, and maintained a standing army of 27,000 men. In 1688, Frederick William died, and his son Frederick I transformed Brandenburg and Prussia into a kingdom. He was crowned in 1701 as King of Prussia. In this way began the power of Prussia, which now rules all Germany and aims to rule the world. The second king of Prussia was Frederick William I. He increased the army to 84,000 men. He spent practically all of his time reviewing and drilling his soldiers and ruled Prussia as a side issue. He ruled with an iron hand, declaring to those who remonstrated, "Salvation belongs to the Lord. Everything else is my business." He made Prussia the best-ruled kingdom on the continent. He also laid up vast sums of money. These sums were used by his son Frederick II, who began his reign in 1740. Almost at the beginning of his reign, Frederick began to plan how he might get more territory. Prussia and Brandenburg, the two provinces of his kingdom, were separated from each other. Cleves, a small state near the northern boundary of France, also belonged to him. Hence his kingdom consisted of parts which were widely separated from each other, and they were therefore difficult to defend and hard to govern. His first step towards his desire was aimed at Silesia. This was a province of Austria, but by an old agreement, when the direct heirs to the throne failed, the province was to come under the control of the King of Prussia. When this happened, Austria had made a trade with Prussia, by which the province remained a part of Austria, while Prussia got other satisfaction instead. While this trade had apparently been satisfactory to Prussia, nevertheless, Frederick used this old claim to Silesia as a basis for now claiming it from Austria. The ruler of Austria was a woman, Maria Theresa, who Frederick thought would not be able to withstand him. Without declaring war on Austria, Frederick invaded Silesia and, when he had control of the province, served notice on Austria that he claimed the province as his own. A war followed in which Frederick was victorious and Silesia remained in his hands. Later, Maria Theresa fought another war with Frederick to try and regain possession of Silesia. Nearly all the countries of Europe were engaged, and it even extended to America, being known here as the French and Indian War. Though he had to fight against terrible odds in this war, Frederick was finally successful, and at its end, Silesia was still his. The seizure of Silesia was without shadow of right or justice, and its retention was unfortunate since it showed Prussia that strong armies could enforce a claim which justice would not allow. Poland had long been a turbulent and disorganized country. Its nobles were lawless and unrestrained, and its government was only one merely in name, as most of the nobles did exactly as they chose. Catherine of Russia, Frederick, and Maria Theresa formed a plan to take part of its territories for themselves without any claim except that which the weak condition of Poland offered. The plan was carried out, and Poland shorn one-third of its territory. Of this, Catherine got the largest part, and Frederick the smallest. But Frederick's share of the plunder was very important to him, since the part he took lay between his two provinces, Prussia and Brandenburg. There has never been an event in the history of modern times which reflects a greater discredit on a country than this division of Poland and the two later divisions which finally removed Poland from the list of nations. It is significant in showing that Frederick the Great had no higher code of ethics in his dealing with his neighbors than a highwayman who takes what he wishes if he can and where he can. Under Frederick the Great, Prussia was transformed into a land of wealth and comfort. Its only rival in Germany was Austria. In all matters where he dealt with foreign states, Frederick was alert to aggrandize Prussia and glorify himself without any regard to truth, honesty, or honor, but in all dealings with his own people he was honest and true. During this time, the remainder of Germany was made up of independent states, which had increased from about 300 to about 1800. However, it was still called the Holy Roman Empire. About the year 1800, Napoleon of France conquered Germany and organized it into 40 states. In 1806, Napoleon nearly crushed the military power of Prussia at the Battle of Jena. By command of Napoleon, the term of the Holy Roman Empire was dropped. Francis II of Austria was the last German emperor to bear the nominal title of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. The Battle of Jena had shown the weakness of Prussia. Immediately after this, Prussia began a series of social reforms. The conditions of the peasants improved, and laws were passed providing for better government of the cities. The nobles were shorn of many of their privileges, and the common people were given a better chance to improve their condition. Napoleon did not allow Prussia to keep a standing army of more than 42,000 men. The Prussians evaded this by letting trained men retire to private life from time to time and calling others to take their place in camp. In a little while, Prussia had an army of 150,000 men thoroughly trained for war. A group of patriotic men succeeded in leading the people to a higher standard of patriotism and earnest effort for the betterment of the state. Thus, out of the defeat which Napoleon had inflicted on Prussia, was born a new Prussia with higher ideals and more loyalty to the best interests of the country. In 1813, the Prussians united with Russia, Austria, and Sweden, and defeated Napoleon in the Battle of Nations at Leipzig. In 1815, after Waterloo, Prussia assumed her former place again, and Germany formed a confederacy of 38 states. This confederation included Austria and Prussia. It was very weak and could enforce nothing. Soon it became the laughingstock of Europe. When peace was made in 1815, after the fall of Napoleon, Prussia was given control of Saxony and the Rhine provinces. Education was later pushed in all parts of Prussia. In 1850, Frederick William IV of Prussia signed Prussia's first written constitution. In 1835, the first railway was built in Germany, but trade was hampered by the duties between the independent states. This was overcome by the formation of a trade union, which permitted goods to pass free of duty from state to state. Prussia was at the head of this trade union. In 1858, William I became ruler of Prussia. He was tremendously energetic. He reorganized and increased the army of Prussia to approximately 400,000 men. He did this even though the Prussian parliament refused to sanction his efforts and refused to appropriate the money. He called Otto von Bismarck to his side as advisor and helper. In one of his first public speeches in parliament, Bismarck frankly said, "The great questions of the time are not to be decided by speeches and votes of the majorities, but by blood and iron." This has been and is now the Prussian policy. William I and Bismarck, with the army behind them, followed the policy of blood and iron and found a pretext over which to wage a war for supremacy with Austria. In 3 weeks from the declaration of war, Prussia overcame Austria on July 3, 1866, at Sandowa. Prussia now held the power of dictator over all Germany, and a closer union of German states began. In 1870, Napoleon III was Emperor of the French. He had been neutral during the Austro-Prussian War, and there was an understanding that Prussia would see that he received some compensation for this. The compensation was refused by Prussia when peace finally came. Napoleon was therefore anxious for revenge. When it was later suggested that Leopold of Hohenzollern, a relative of William I, should be made King of Spain, he saw in this a further attempt to extend the already great power of Prussia. He objected to the plan, and it was given up. Then he made a further demand on King William regarding Leopold, which the king did not agree to. Bismarck saw in this a chance to arouse feeling in France which would bring about war, and as Prussia was ready for war with France, and saw that such a war must come sooner or later, he gave out the news of this last demand in such a way that France was roused to indignation and Napoleon was compelled to declare war on Prussia. The news which Bismarck gave out was expressed in such a way that Germany was as indignant against France as France was against Prussia, and immediately all Germany united with Prussia against France. The war was short. The Germans and Prussians were entirely successful. Paris was captured by the Prussians in January 1871. By the terms of the treaty that followed, Prussia, under the direction of Bismarck, took Alsace-Lorraine, which in the days of the old German-Roman Empire had belonged to Germany. In addition, an indemnity of $1 billion was extracted by Prussia, and Prussian troops remained in France until this was paid. The bitter feeling of France for Germany dates from the War of 1870. The French have longed for revenge and the recovery of their lost provinces. In January 1871, all the German states united and the German Empire began with William I, King of Prussia, and a member of the House of Hohenzollern as first German Emperor or Deutscher Kaiser. Footnote, the word Kaiser is the German for Caesar. In this, the Germans retain one reminder of the days when German kings ruled on the thrones of the Caesars at Rome. The long conflict for union was now at an end, and Germany was ready to battle for her place among the great nations of the world. The German emperor was given great power in government matters. As King of Prussia, he came to control sufficient votes to block any measure in the Bundesrat, Federal Council. The German emperor appoints and dismisses the imperial chancellor. The imperial chancellor receives all his authority from the emperor and is not bound in any way by the votes of the Bundesrat or Reichstag. The Bundesrat in Germany corresponds somewhat to the Senate in the United States and the Reichstag to the House of Representatives. The imperial chancellor presides over the Bundesrat. The Reichstag is the great debating society of Germany. It has little real power and is called by the Germans the Hall of Echoes. As chancellor of William I, Bismarck took every possible measure to strengthen the imperial government. In spite of opposition from many sources, he was successful, and the government now controlled practically everything in Germany. Since 1871, industrial work, manufacturing, and education have made tremendous progress. In the pursuit of trade, Germany has sailed every sea and penetrated every country in the world. In 1884, Germany first began its colonial possessions by the founding of colonies in Togoland and Cameroon. Previous to the Great War, Germany held the following colonial possessions: Togoland, Cameroon, German Southwest Africa, German East Africa, North New Guinea, Bismarck, Archipelago, Caroline Islands, and a part of the Samoan Islands. Germany had also other small possessions. The population of the colonial possessions of Germany was about 14 million people. Germany had over 1,000 miles of canals. Among the most important of these is the Kiel Canal, connecting the Baltic and the North Seas. The Ludwig Canal connects the Doab and the main branch of the Rhine so that boats can pass from the North Sea to the Black Sea. William I died in March 1888. His son Frederick became emperor until June of the same year when he died. William II, the eldest son of Frederick, then became emperor of Germany. This is the present Kaiser. His mother was Victoria, the eldest daughter of Victoria, Queen of England. William II desired to be his own imperial chancellor, and so dismissed Bismarck, saying, "I have taken up the reins of government looking for aid to the King of Kings." Under William II, the German government has become the least democratic of any in Europe. The following from the proclamations of the Kaiser indicate very clearly his attitude in the matter. Only one is master in the empire, and I am that one. I will tolerate no other. I represent monarchy by the grace of God. You must all have one will, and that is my will. There is only one law, and that law is my law. If I order you to shoot down relatives, brothers, yes, even parents, you must do it. Woe and death unto those who oppose my will. Let all the enemies of the German nation perish. God demands their destruction. Education has been encouraged. Germany and the United States have exchanged university professors. In Germany, industrial education has been emphasized, also military education. It has come about in Germany that all education has been along three following lines: industrial education, military education, and professional education. For the last 20 years, many Americans have not considered their education complete until they had spent some time in study in Germany. Less than 0.5% of the German people are unable to read and write. The educational system has therefore been very effective. The school days and school term are longer in Germany than in the United States. The teachers in the schools are nearly all men of experience, and they hold their positions for life. Prussia had been the military schoolmaster of Europe. At the opening of the Great War, Germany contained 208,780 square miles and a population of 66,615,000 people. William II is a type of modern German, resourceful, energetic, commanding. Like Frederick the Great, he uses honest or dishonest, kind or cruel methods to promote his notions of what constitutes German interests. He leads his nation, heads it, directs it. Germany has great coal, iron, zinc, and salt mines. It has great forests and other natural resources. The chief agricultural crop is the sugar beet. The income from this pays for a large part of the wheat and rye which is imported into Germany. A summary. The Germans probably came from Asia. Since the dawn of history, they have occupied Central Europe. For 400 years, they were held in check by the Romans. After long struggles with the Romans, they finally overcame them and ruled at Rome for about 800 years. All the nations of Western Europe are descendants of the branches of the Teutonic tribes of long ago. The Protestant religion began and was originated in Germany by a German and caused 100 years of cruel wars. Prussia, the military schoolmaster of Europe, has organized and developed modern Germany. Prussia, with her military aims, is responsible for the Great War. William II, the Hohenzollern King of Prussia and the Emperor of Germany, has recalled to his people the greatness of Germany's past and has set them the task of again ruling Europe.
Great Britain. When Caesar invaded the island of Britain just before the Christian era, he found there people of the Celtic race. Of these people we know little except that they were brave fighters and gave Caesar and the Romans much trouble before they were finally subdued. The Romans conquered the southern part of the island except Wales and held it for about 400 years. Traces of their occupation of Britain are still to be seen. The Romans never succeeded in subduing the northern part of the island or Wales, and the people there still speak a language which has some resemblance to the old Celtic tongue. Probably the Welsh people are nearest to the original Celtic stock. After the time of the Romans, the Angles and the Saxons came over from the mainland of Europe and overran the island. These people established small kingdoms which were finally combined into one about the time of Charlemagne. Later, tribes of the Northmen from the Scandinavian countries invaded the island and for a time controlled the southern part of it. In 1066, William the Norman, a French duke of the stock of the Northmen, invaded England and defeated Harold the English king, became king in his place. The descendants of William have sat on the British throne until the present time. The Anglo-Saxons and the Normans finally merged into one people, and the present English people are the result of this combination. The island of Britain has not suffered from invasion of any hostile people from William's time to the present day. Whatever foreign wars the British people have been fought on soil other than their own, though there have been many wars between different parties of the people of the island. Scotland and England fought for many years until finally the countries came under one head, and since they have been known as Great Britain. Ireland was overcome by the British and has been for centuries under their rule, though there has always been a party of the Irish which has wished to make Ireland free from their control. Wales was conquered by the English some 600 years ago and has since then been a part of England. For centuries, the British kings tried to get possession of some part of the continent of Europe, and nearly every war that was fought with a European power up to the 18th century was fought for the purpose of getting such power or keeping power already gained. They were in control of a large part of France for many years, and even within 100 years, part of Germany was under British rule. But with the rise of the modern states of Europe, the British were forced to give up their claims to European territory and content themselves with territory outside Europe. After the discovery of America, the British people began to turn their attention to the New World. Gradually, it began to dawn on them that the land here was worth possessing, and a beginning was made of the splendid colonial empire they now hold. Great Britain's claim to the respect and admiration of the world is threefold. First, she has developed the principles of constitutional government better than any other people have. Second, she has found the greatest colonial empire the world has ever seen, and has succeeded in ruling it so well that the people she has conquered have respected and, in the end, liked her rule. Third, she has become the greatest commercial power in the world. The first of these has enabled her to grow and develop without the domestic trouble which have afflicted a country in which the people are governed without their own consent, and have allowed her to do without a large standing army to keep the people within control. Thus, her people have had less burden of expense and have been united to pursue the great ends they sought in the world. The second has shown her farsightedness, for without colonial possession she could never have gained the power or wealth she has today. The wisdom of this has been shown further in present war when every colony has rallied to the defense of her threatened power. The third has been necessary for Great Britain because of her position on islands where she must import most of the raw materials for her manufacturers. The manufactured articles must also be transported where they may find markets. Hence, commerce is necessary to her existence as a nation. The Norman Conquest in 1066 placed the government of England under an absolute monarchy. There was no known way in which the will of the people could be asserted effectively in opposition to the will of the king. No change was made until 1100, when Henry I, in order to gain the support of the nobles against his brother Robert and win favor for himself, gave a charter in which the nobles were granted certain privileges and rights which they in turn had to grant to the people who were under their power. This was the beginning of successive charters, which were granted by kings to the nobles, and which in time curtailed the power of the king considerably. King John, one of the worst kings England ever had, was the means of the second advance in the growth of the Constitution. In 1215, he was forced by the barons who rose in revolt against him on account of his oppression of them to grant the Great Charter. This gave the barons and people certain rights which the king could not take from them in the future. Among these rights were the following: the right of trial by jury, the right of habeas corpus, and certain restrictions on the right of the king to raise money without due process of law. What the king was forbidden to do with relation to the barons, they were also forbidden to do with relation to the people under their power, and hence the charter was really a charter of rights for the whole people. Implied in it was the fact that a king who did not observe the charter had no right to the obedience of the people, and hence it really provided means for keeping the kind from breaking it. A footnote: habeas corpus is a writ by which a man accused of a crime can claim a trial within a reasonable length of time. Now, under the reign of John's successor, Parliament acquired considerable power, and under the reign of his son Edward I, it gained the right to grant all sums of money raised by taxing the people. During this reign, Parliament was organized in the manner in which it still exists. The next advance in the making of the British Constitution was during the reign of Charles I. For over 150 years, Parliament had been subservient to the will of the king or the queen for this period, was that of the strong rules of the Tudor family and the Stuarts. Charles was unpopular with a large part of the people, however, and his attempts to rule without Parliament having anything to do except register his wishes raised trouble. A petition of right was introduced and passed, and the king was compelled to agree to it before Parliament would grant him any money. The petition of right prohibited the king from acting in an arbitrary manner and defined certain rights of the people. It is the second great document in the history of the British Constitution. In 1688, the Bill of Rights was passed by Parliament and agreed to by King William and Queen Mary on their accession to the throne. This was the third great charter of the rights of the British people. It provided considerable detail for the exercise of their rights by the people and made the king for the future dependent on Parliament for his power and the money he needed to carry on the government. While the British Constitution is not a single written law as our own Constitution is, it is not the less binding at the present time on the king and the nation. It marks the slow growth of popular government in replacing the absolute power which the Norman kings had. It is significant to note that the advances in its growth have come during the rule of kings who were weak and inclined to be unfair to the people or the nobles. Hence, it is apparently true that the Anglo-Saxon people have never allowed their rulers to forget that they held their power by grace of the people. Even the Tudors, Henry VII, Henry VIII, and Elizabeth, all of whom were strong rulers, always consulted Parliament, even though during their reign this was a mere formality, as Parliament always agreed to do what they wanted. Since the time of William and Mary, every British sovereign has been formally approved by Parliament and crowned after agreeing to support the ancient laws embodied in the three charters above referred to. Great Britain is therefore a country governed under a constitution which gives the people the most power and allows the king less power than is given our own president. Parliament consists of two houses, the upper composed of the nobles and certain of the clergy, the lower of representatives chosen by the people. At the present time, the lower house, or the House of Commons, has the sole right to introduce bills for raising money, and the upper house, or House of Lords, has very little real power. The ministers composing the cabinet are dependent on the vote of Parliament, and if their measures are not passed by Parliament, the cabinet is to resign and a new cabinet is chosen from the party of the majority in the Commons. The king can choose the premier or leader of the cabinet, but his choice has to be agreeable to the commons. The king has the veto power, but it has not been used since 1707, and any bill which is passed by Parliament is approved by the king without question. This comes about in this way. No bill can become a law without the approval of the ministry, since the ministry has to be able to count on the majority of the Parliament if it holds power. If the king were to veto a bill, therefore the ministry would resign and the country would be left without a government, since the king could not appoint a new ministry, for the majority party would not approve it. Hence, though in theory the king has power to veto a bill, he really cannot do so in practice. The second claim of Great Britain to respect is on account of her colonial empire. This was started when she found that she could not maintain her hold on Europe, and when the growing numbers of her population forced her to find room for them outside her limits. Her earliest colonies were in North America. Unlike the colonial policy of France and of Spain, England thought of colonies as places where English people might go to live and develop the country. France sought colonies as trading stations. Spain sought them for the purpose of getting from them all she could. The Plymouth colony was the first colony, which exemplified the English idea, and the later colonies started in America by the English were of the same sort. It is not possible in this short sketch to trace the gradual growth of the colonial empire of Great Britain. Today, she has colonies in every part of the world, some gained by settlement, some by conquest, some by treaty agreements, but all united to the mother country by strong and loyal ties. The American Revolution has long been thought of as a revolution brought about by entire disagreement between England and the colonies. In fact, however, the same struggle which went on here between the colonies and the British government was going on at the same time in England. The troops sent here to attempt to subdue the colonies were hired by the British king in Europe, and the war was intensely unpopular with the British people as a whole. The king then was George III, an obstinate and narrow-minded man who for 12 years governed the country in much the same way as the Stuarts had tried during the 17th century. The same revolt which the American colonists made, and which ended for them in gaining their independence from England, was being fought out in England by such great Englishmen as Pitt, Fox, and Burke, who opposed the war with the colonies and declared that they were right in their opposition to the kind of government which England then had. What the colonies gained by fighting until they got their independence, these Englishmen gained somewhat later by overthrowing the personal rule of George III and reforming Parliament so that it represented the will of the majority of the people of England. This unfortunate experience was not repeated by the British government, and the reforms in Parliament later made it impossible for a ruler to control the government against the will of the people. A splendid example of the ability of the British people to govern their colonies so as to gain their affection is that of the Boers in South Africa. In 1902, after a war in which the British were able with great difficulty to conquer the Boer republics, they were made a part of the British dominions. So well did the British govern them, and so well did they heal the scars of hard feeling, that when the Great War broke out in 1914, the Germans tried to start a rebellion in South Africa and succeeded in getting a party of the Boers to attempt a revolt. General Botha, who had been a leader of the Boers in their fight against the British 12 years before, led the forces of British South Africans against the revolutionists and put down the attempted revolt. India, which the Germans thought could be roused against the British, was loyal and sent help both in men and money. The same thing happened in every colony which was able to help. Great Britain has bound her colonies to herself so well that they believe their welfare is one with the welfare of Great Britain. During the 16th and 17th centuries, England fought wars with Spain, Holland, Portugal, and France, and from these wars emerged as the greatest naval power in the world. This supremacy has always since been maintained, and today Great Britain has a larger fleet of warships than any other power. Her rule for years has been to build as many warships as the nearest two of her competitors have built. This has been necessary since she is an island power and has the largest fleet of merchant ships of any nation. To protect these and her colonies in every part of the world, she needed a fleet of warships which could not be equaled by any two other powers. The present war has shown her farsightedness in this regard. With her great fleet and her immense commerce, however, she has been willing to allow all nations to use the high seas without hindrance. Germany demands free seas, but neither she nor any other nation has ever known what it meant not to have free seas. Great Britain's naval power has made the seas safe for all the nations of the world in time of peace. It has long been a mark of patriotism in our country to speak slightingly of England. We have remembered the feelings of hatred of our forefathers for the unjust British government which drove us to revolt and seek out freedom from her. It is well to remember that Englishmen fought the same fight at home against the same government and won it as we did. It is also well to remember that Great Britain has not always opposed our aims. During the Spanish-American War, when Dewey had beaten the Spanish fleet in Manila Bay, there was a German fleet in the harbor, and there were also some British warships. The German commander sent word to Dewey not to attempt to take Manila, or the German fleet would have to oppose him. The British commander promptly moved his ships over on the side of the American vessels, and the German commander withdrew his demand. The British commander later said that blood is thicker than water. Thus Great Britain showed that she is willing for us to settle our battle with Spain without interference, and so she took her place beside us finally. The present war has brought our nation and Great Britain together more closely in fighting for the future freedom of the world, from the dangers which autocratic government may bring it. The Anglo-Saxon people are fighting again for the freedom through the world which they have won for themselves in their own governments, to decide their own future without dictation by any self-seeking person or people.
Austria-Hungary. Austria-Hungary is the second largest country in Europe in area and is situated in the central arc of Europe, surrounded by Germany, Russia, Switzerland, Italy, and the Balkan countries. It touches on the Adriatic Sea, but it has only a short seacoast. Its surface is broken by many mountain ranges between which lie fertile valleys. The Danube runs for a considerable part of its length through the empire and furnishes an easy means of transportation from one part of a country to the other. The scenery in Austria-Hungary is very fine, particularly in the western part and in the valley of the Danube. Of the two parts of the empire, Hungary is in the center, nearly surrounded on three sides by the provinces of Austria. Austria proper is west of Hungary-Bohemia. One of the Erstrina states is north of Hungary, projecting into Germany, while Galicia, another Austrian state, is northeast of Hungary. Hungary is mainly plain and is separated from Bohemia and Galicia by mountain ranges. The plains of Hungary form the best wheat-producing region in Europe. The mineral wealth of the mountainous sections of the empire are largely undeveloped, though it is very great. Manufactures are not very extensive, though some manufactures have been important for a long time, for example, porcelain, and Bohemian glass and salt. As a rule, however, the country imports its manufactured articles and exports its raw materials. As Western Europe is densely populated, the food exports of Austria-Hungary are easily disposed of to Germany and other Western European countries. The government of the empire is divided into two parts. The Emperor of Austria becomes King of Hungary by election by the Hungarian Parliament. Both Austria and Hungary have their own parliaments, each composed of two houses according to the usual plan, and each parliament has power in local matters. Regarding matters which concern both Austria and Hungary, however, neither parliament has much to say. These matters are decided by a body of 60 delegates chosen partly by each parliament. In Austria, the German population has practically the whole power, though these people are a minority of the whole population. While in Hungary, the Magyars are in control, and they are a minority of the people in Hungary. This is possible on account of the representation of the different states in the parliament states, and the same way with the Magyars. The first inhabitants of Austria were Celts, or Gauls, probably. Other tribes came into the country, and these were gradually subdued by the Romans until the first century. Nearly the whole of the present empire was under Roman rule. Later, the Goths came, and with their coming, the Romans withdrew from the country, leaving, however, their trace of civilization, which the invaders absorbed very readily. Hence, Austria did not go back into barbarism as some parts of the Roman Empire did after the Romans had to leave them. Christianity also held its own and replaced the rude heathen customs of the newcomers. The invasion of the Huns somewhat later drove out the Goths, who were no match for them from the eastern part of the country, and gave the name of Hungary to it. The Slavs and Avars came later and overran the country, but they were finally conquered by the Franks under Charlemagne. The present empire began with a small state which Charlemagne founded south of the Danube, and which grew by additions, until in the 15th century it was raised to the dignity of an archduchy, which became one of the important states of Germany. About the year 900, the Magyars invaded the eastern part of the present empire and founded the Kingdom of Hungary. They were, however, unable to hold the western part of the country, which has ever since been German in character. In 1273, Rudolf of Habsburg, the ancestor of the present ruler of Austria-Hungary, was elected emperor of Germany. The Habsburgs came from Switzerland, which was then part of Austria. Under Rudolf's successor, the Swiss revolted, and after a long war, gained their freedom, and thus the original home of the Habsburg was no longer under control of the rulers of Austria. The Habsburgs have ruled Austria from Rudolf's time to the present day. Generally, the Emperor of Austria was also the Emperor of Germany, which dignity was elective, and the different states of Germany, of which Austria was only one, decided who should have the honor. Perhaps the greatest ruler of all the Habsburgs was the Emperor Charles V, who ruled over Spain, Austria, Germany, and the Netherlands during the first part of the 16th century. Hungary was for a long time under the power of the Turks, who repeatedly ravaged the country, but in 1571 it became a part of Austria and has remained so from that time to the present, though the Hungarians have many times tried to get their freedom from Austria. Another great ruler of Austria was Maria Theresa, who was queen during the middle of the 18th century. During her reign, Prussia took from Austria Upper Silesia, but still at her death she left the country considerably larger than when she began her rule by having helped the Prussians and the Russians to break up the Kingdom of Poland, which each of the three took a slice. In 1787, the Netherlands were separated from Austria after having been under her control for centuries. During the French Revolution, Austria joined with other European powers in trying to save the French king from death, and after his death, kept up her hostility to France until the Emperor Napoleon of France defeated Austria, compelling her to give up her provinces in Italy and otherwise humbling her. On Napoleon's banishment, however, Austria got back most of her territory, but the Austrian ruler who had been Emperor of Germany at that time gave up the title and became simply Emperor of Austria, which title the Austrian ruler has at the present time. This was the end of what was known as the Holy Roman Empire, which was founded by Charlemagne, and which was really a German empire, and had German or Austrian rulers, and they had little real power except in the states of Germany from which they came. It will be remembered that this title had been in the family of the Austrian rulers for more than 500 years. In 1848, Francis Joseph succeeded to the throne of Austria-Hungary. His long reign lasted until after the World War began, and he was directly responsible for its beginning. During his reign, Austria was driven out of Italy, where she had been in power for hundreds of years. Prussia took away from Austria the leadership of Germany, which she had held for nearly 600 years. Bosnia and Herzegovina were annexed to Austria, which aroused the opposition of the Balkan states and was partly responsible for the outbreak of the present war. And the governments of Austria and Hungary were reformed so that the people had a part in making of the laws, and the condition of the people was very greatly improved in many ways. Austria is made up of many different peoples, and each of them has a very keen desire to govern itself in its local matters. There is not any considerable feeling of loyalty to the empire on the part of the greater number of people in the country. This makes the government of the country very difficult, and gives rise to plots and revolts, which have for their aim the breaking up of the empire into smaller states. It has long been said that the death of the old emperor, Francis Joseph, would see the breaking up of the empire. But as his death occurred during the World War, it seems likely now that the empire will survive in its present form unless the defeat of the Central Powers allows the Allies to remake the map of Europe according to their own ideas. How have the Habsburgs succeeded in ruling an empire with so many different races whose people are hostile to the government? This secret lies in the ability with which the government has appealed to the jealousy with which every race looks on every other within the empire. The government has played off against each other the parties which have promised to become troublesome to it and encouraged them to quarrel among themselves. Thus, their energies have been used up, and they have ceased to be dangerous to the government. As long as sectional feeling can be used in this way, the Habsburgs will be able to rule Austria. It is not a very high order of government, which has to depend for its support on the mutual jealousies which exist within the people it rules, rather than on the recognition of its ability to raise the people up to higher standards of living, and to make them happier and more prosperous. But this is the foundation on which rests the power of the government of the Habsburgs.
Russia. Russia is, next to Great Britain, the largest empire in the world. It occupies the greater part of Europe and over one-third of Asia. Its surface is generally low and flat, with few mountain ranges except those of its southern border and the Ural Range between European and Asiatic Russia. The southern part of European Russia is a great grain-producing region, while the northern part is marshy and frozen for the greater part of the year. Russia has no seaports except on the Black Sea, which are open the year round, and she is therefore at a disadvantage as far as commerce is concerned. Most of the people live in the central and southern parts of the country and are believed to have come originally from the region of the Carpathians. They belong to the white race and were various tribes of the Slavs. Later tribes of the Scythians, Goths, Avars, Bulgarians, Mongols, and many other peoples entered the country, few to remain, but all to leave a lasting impression on the nation. In all European Russia, there is not one single natural dividing line so that the different races have not been able to develop separately and retain their own characteristics, but have mingled together and formed the people we know as the Russians. This commingling of races did not come about quickly or easily, and for centuries the Russians were the prey of invaders who swept in upon them from all sides. The whole country was therefore in a state of disorder and strife constantly because of the lack of union among the people. Even at the present, in spite of the commingling of races, which has been going on for so long, there are marked differences between the people of different sections of Russia, though not the differences we find in some other parts of Europe. Sometime during the 9th century, a large company of Scandinavians under Rurik entered the country by invitation, it is said, and established a form of government with their capital at Novgorod. At this time, the people began to be called Russians, probably owing to the name of Rus given by the Finns to the Scandinavians. The rulers following Rurik were able to extend their authority over the country to the east and the south. This was usually done by gaining control of cities and centers of population. These cities, of which there were many, had a tendency toward a republican form of government and were governed by officers elected by the people. Each district comprised the territory brought under control of Rurik, and his successors was known by the name of the principal city within it. The usual custom for many years was for the several districts of the kingdom to be divided among the sons of the ruler upon his death. This repeatedly led to plotting murder and fighting until only one son remained, who then took charge of all the districts under the title of Grand Prince. The Russian state held together under these unfavorable conditions for 200 years after the time of Rurik, because usually there was but one son of the Grand Prince, and no one but a descendant of Rurik was permitted to rule. It was one of his descendants, Vladimir I, who introduced the religion of the Greek Church into Russia. During the 11th and 12th centuries, there was no union of the Russian people under one government. This time is known as the period of principalities, and was one of the most troublous and confused in Russian history. Up to this time, the customs and habits of the Russians, while barbaric, kept pace fairly well with progress in Western Europe. Now progress came to a standstill, and the bad condition of the country left it open to invasions of tribes of Mongols called Tartars, who came from Asia, and whose influence set back the civilization of the Russians for centuries. For over 200 years, the Tartars overran the Russian provinces. They had no desire to take possession of the soil, but desired movable property which they could take away with them to their own country. As soon as they had their authority recognized, they sent officials into the country to estimate the value of the property of the people and to collect taxes in proportion to the population. They did not send officers into the country to rule it, but selected Russians for the purpose, and in time the princes, instead of trying to throw off the Tartar yoke, tried to gain their favor in order to make their own position secure and, if possible, extend their power at the expense of their neighbors. Thus matters in Russia seemed to be going from bad to worse until a change came about in Moscow, and direct succession to the throne from father to eldest son was established instead of the division of districts of the princedom among all of the sons of the dead ruler. This change had remarkable results. Not only did it do away with the endless quarrels between brothers, but it tended to unite the people more firmly together as a nation until their strength was so great that they were able to throw off the Tartar yoke. The church also assisted in the overthrow of the Tartars. In earlier times, when Russia was in a state of confusion, the church had acted as a mediator between the different parties and had assisted in restoring order. The Tartars recognized the influence of the church and tried to gain its favor by increasing its privileges and exempting it from taxes. The monks of the Greek church, thus aided by the Tartars and not being troubled by the political quarrels which tended to reduce the power of the princes, gradually grew to have greater authority even than the princes. Contrary to the hopes of the Tartars, however, the monks saw that the welfare of the country lay in the establishment of a strong central government. They encouraged the policy of direct succession to the throne and worked towards the end of securing for the central government complete national authority. After the expulsion of the Tartars, the Grand Prince took the high-sounding title of Tsar and grew to have absolute authority over the government. The period following was no less dark than the period of the Tartar rule. Bound by no law but their own will, the Tsars put down uprisings by a reign of terror. Individuals and even whole cities were put to death without trial and on mere suspicion or as a result of lies of deceiving persons. The crowning act of barbarity of this period was the butchering of 60,000 citizens of Novgorod by the order of Ivan the Terrible. The cause of this was a desire of a criminal to revenge himself on the magistrates of Novgorod for the punishment which he had received at their hands for a crime which he had committed. He caused a letter written by himself, not pretending to come from the archbishop and the inhabitants of the city, and addressed to the king of Poland to fall into the hands of the Tsar. In this letter the citizens apparently offered to put their city under the protection of the Polish monarch. Historians try to excuse Ivan on the grounds that he was insane, but he and other rulers of that time made the period truly a reign of terror. If the lives of the nobles were in constant danger, the condition of the common people must have been unbearable. Though the Tsar knew no law but his own will, the nobles were restrained by a few unwritten laws. They could not kill one of their own or higher rank without punishment, though the punishment was usually a fine only. There were no law or customs protecting the peasant or serf, as he was called, and he was more truly a slave than the Africans in America, if that were possible. During this terrible period, the Russian state, though often suffering from invasions from outside, began to unite and extend its territory. Siberia was explored by a body of Cossacks, its capital captured, and the whole country annexed to Russia. The Cossacks were people living along the southern border of European Russia. The name originally meant men without homes, celibates, obliged to work for others. These men, opposed to life in villages, were attracted by the fertile steppes. They were joined by many runaway serfs and criminals and grew up in hardy tribes without distinct nationality, except that they were Russians more than anything else at heart. They are well known as brave and sturdy fighters. With the coming to the throne of Peter the Great, better times came to Russia. Peter encouraged the nobles to become better educated. He traveled incognito through Western Europe and learned at first hand what more civilized countries had to offer. This led to great advancement in trade, industry, and education. It is said that Peter the Great civilized Russia, though he was himself a barbarian. Russian territory was enlarged still further about this time by the annexation of Lithuania and the larger part of Poland. From this time on, Russia became more and more in contact with Western Europe and came to be, in fact, one of the great powers of Europe. A great day for Russia was February 19, 1861, for on that day was accomplished the greatest event in Russian history. Alexander II signed the Emancipation Proclamation of the Serfs, freeing over 22 million people from practical slavery and providing means for them to buy homes by the help of the government. Soon, attempts were made to provide education for them also. No doubt these attempts have helped the people some, but Russian education for the lower classes has been, and still is, sadly neglected. Most of the Russian people are extremely ignorant. This is not true of the upper classes, for they are well educated and have shown themselves equal to the people of any race in intelligence. The 19th century was the period when European countries formed alliances between the great powers. During the days of Napoleon, Russia and Prussia drifted closer together, but toward the end of the century, a distrust of Germany and Austria grew in Russia over the Polish question, and Russia learned that her safety lay in better understanding with the French. Gradually, a secret understanding between Russia and France grew stronger until finally the two governments openly admitted that they were allies. With the growth of education in Russia during this period, the people gradually began to fear the power of a government controlled by one man. Minor revolutions and murmurings were heard. For a time, all disturbances were put down. Old traditions and customs were too strong. The unfortunate result of the war with Japan in 1904-1905 showed the Russian people the weakness of their government compared with those of other nations. This forced the Tsar to agree to a constitution. The constitution granted provided for a Congress called the Duma, made up of members chosen by the people. Not all the people, however, had a right to vote, and the influence of the Tsar was sufficient to keep the Duma from doing very much at first, but the establishment of the Duma was a step in advance and marked the beginning of the end of autocratic rule in Russia.